That's the price you pay. And there are, you know, there are a lot of people out there who will go through all kinds of strange maneuvers to get their VisWatt down from 1.1 to 1.0. But if you do the math about how much reflected loss that entails, you wonder what's the matter with them. So, you know, some people do odd things. Math is a curious thing, and some people do better math than other people.
Yeah. Well, the Army was very successful, and the Department of State was very successful with an antenna called T2FD, which was basically a folded dipole with a 12-to-1 balance and a 500-ohm resistor in the center at the top. And that resistor dissipated a lot of heat. But you could tune that antenna on any frequency, and it worked great.
Okay, that's an interesting design. I mean, that sounds sort of like a beverage antenna. I mean, was it a standing wave, or was it a walking wave?
Picture a folded dipole. Picture the distance between the conductors is about 11 inches. At the top, in the center, you've got a 500-ohm resistor. At the bottom, in the center, you've got a 16-to-1 balance. The antenna is 100 feet long, 50 feet on a side.
Okay, again, it sort of sounds very beverish, which make great receiving antennas, but not really good to transmitting, so I'll have to look that one up.
Now, the beverage has the resistor at the end. This antenna is called T2FD, Tango 2 Fox Delta, or folded dipole, maybe. N2KW out.
K2GJE?
Yes, GJE. How you doing, Ed?
Doing good. Don't forget, with all these balance that we're using to feed an NFET half wave. The balun has two wires on the input, which is usually a piece of coax connector, and the output may have two hooks. You have to use both of them for the other side of the transformer. So one goes to the NFET, the other wire you either connect to a random piece of wire, or you hook it to the outside of the coax over.
Yes, that's true, but I think what we were trying to get at is the problem is that almost no one truly operates a half-wave NFET purely as a half-wave NFET. They always kind of veer off that perfect point in which then you still need to ground properly your system. Otherwise, the laws of physics will simply take your coax cable feeding into your shack and use that as your counterpoise. So it's always good to have a proper ground, even when you're operating theoretically as a pure half-wave NFET.
I had a very interesting antenna years ago. I had three half waves long piece of wire that I set to make an impedance match by connecting the coax a quarter wave off one end over.
Okay, so you kind of used a stub, right?
No, it's not a stub. Imagine just three half waves long. I think on 20 meters you need about 30 feet, so it was about 90 feet long, and I set it 15 feet from one end over.
Okay, you got any pictures of that? I'd like to see it.
I wish I had the location that I used it in. I was in Europe, and I had no difficulty reaching the east coast of the United States every night on a regular basis, over.
I'm just curious, were you near the ocean?
No, I was not near the ocean. I was in Bavaria, over.
Stop. Okay, that's an interesting design as well. I mean, that's one of the beauties of this hobby. If you're at all interested in antennas, and Dick, K2RAW, may rest in peace, was a maven on antennas. There are so many different designs and permutations. Three weeks ago, Ed presented us with one that seems relatively new from the pages of QST. It may issue page 30 or so. So they're all fascinating, and, you know, trying to figure out how they work. I mean, I remember getting a migraine trying to figure out how G5RBs work, because they don't work on all frequencies using the same apparent mode. They kind of operate on different modes for different frequencies. So your model is interesting as well.
KG2R1.
Yes, David.
Good evening, good evening. Yeah, but what happens if you have like a very normal, you know, pretty standard kind of antenna, but you have to manipulate it to fit it into the space? Then you find that its direction, it's directional toward certain places and not others and such. And I guess maybe for some reason, you know, you end up in a situation where it's more of a surprise than something that you can predict, you know?
Well, by the way, AC2GS, that is kind of often the case, because almost nothing is built and installed in a perfect theoretical manner. You'll get reflecting objects, absorbing objects. Different things will perturb its radiation pattern, and especially if you have to do zigzags, you may get it to resonate. You may get to talk to people all over the place, but the resultant radiation pattern might give you nulls and peaks all over the place, and direct it. Sometimes it directs you exactly where you want it to go if you're a lucky person and you live a clean life. At other times, it will direct it straight up, and again, we're stuck with a near-vertical incident sky wave, or into the ocean, in which, you know, if you're able to get it over to Europe, then congratulations, but otherwise, if you can't, it's not going to reach Middle America. So, yeah, it's each and every installation of almost every antenna has enough variables that you're not going to be quite sure of what its radiation pattern will ultimately look like. And it's also subject to change by weather conditions and ionization patterns and all kinds of things. I think if you could rely upon your antennas to be the same day in and day out, there would be some hams that would kind of lose their love of the hobby. Because, you know, it was a fait accompli. You know, nothing was going to change. So, yeah, I would agree with you that the radiation pattern for individual antennas are all different. They fit in certain categories, and they fulfill the laws of physics, but the little bits and pieces of nuances can kind of randomize things.
Well, recently, I was talking to a couple of people on this repeater about someone's experience with a vertical. I don't know where it was, but it wasn't very high up, maybe like 5-6 feet in the air. And his three friends tried to call him on 10 meters, and for some reason they couldn't hear him, but they could hear each other. I'm not sure if he could hear them, you know. And I know you were talking about a situation in Brooklyn where in 10 meters, certain areas are somehow blocked out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the problem with 10 meters up until very recently, and still to a degree, is it's very dependent upon sunspot activity. Without a good amount of sunspots, there's very little F ionization, so there's very little refraction, and there's very little skip. and you're kind of stuck with ground wave propagation. With ground wave propagation, it's very dependent upon any kind of a building in your path. We had a case just this morning on 10 meters where I could hear someone and a guy who's only a mile away from me and about 100 feet higher up than me couldn't. And we kind of came to the conclusion that what was going on wasn't necessarily, because, I mean, how many different buildings could be differently blocked just by a mile distance, even less, probably half of a mile? And ultimately, it seemed to be that it was his building itself that was in between the source of the radio signal. So it was getting absorbed by the infrastructure of his apartment house, and he couldn't hear a thing. So, you know, if you're in a valley, you're going to be blocked from ground waves sometimes because it'll hit the hill, it'll hit a tall building. So you got to be kind of very lucky, and occasionally you can kind of play billiards with RF. Sometimes it'll be blocked directly, but it can sometimes reflect off of water towers and things, and I've heard people kind of do that. They'll point their Yagis at a water tower and to be able to bounce it off there. So there's all kinds of different ways that you could deal with ground wave propagation, but that's ground wave. You know, if and when the sunspot activity really livens up and we get a nice ionosphere, then our distance communications aren't going to be blocked by anything on the ground. It's all going to be refracted off of the ionosphere. And, a couple of weeks ago, I was able to talk on 10 meters to California, so I'm looking forward to that in the future.
Couldn't 10 meters conditions be too good, T-O-O, too good for communications over shorter distances?
No, generally speaking, not. For short distances, you're really talking about ground wave propagation where the ionosphere doesn't really have anything to do with it. So you're not going to get a condition, say, where the ionosphere is so energized that it doesn't skip and refract off of it, you know, tens, hundreds of miles, but rather come back out of phase in some way with the ground wave propagation and cause negative interference and disrupt signals. I don't think that's a big problem.
QKW.
Yes, Alan.
Yeah, I believe the question was, can propagation be too good and cover up local signals? And I think the answer is yes. Because, I'll put it in another way, can sky noise cover up a weak signal? Over.
Okay, I mean, if the question is, if the frequency is crowded with a bunch of people who are getting in long distance, are you not going to hear the kind of weak signals locally? Yes, I took it to mean a different thing, that whether strong conditions for propagation cause problems as opposed to propagating signals providing QRM or such. So it sort of depends upon exactly what question you're answering. But I agree with you on your question that you answered, Alan.
No. The incident that I raised was, can sky noise cover up a weak signal? I'm not talking about QRM. I'm not talking about other stations on the frequency. I'm just talking about if the band is closed, your receiver is dead. It's quiet. If the band is open, the receiver is hot. You can hear it hiss. And the question that I asked is, can sky noise cover up a weak signal? Which is a rhetorical question because it can.
Okay. Yeah, that's the third question. That's a good one. Theoretically, yeah, sure. Any kind of noise, whether it's sky wave propagated or ground wave propagated, can increase the noise, and the signal remains the same, and so your signal-to-noise ratio goes into the garbage can. So, yeah, a very good propagation with background noise will diminish your local ability to receive. I don't know if that is a constant. I tend to doubt it. I think there are noisy propagated days and not so noisy propagated days, so it's certainly a factor.
Yeah, you know, when I asked the question about the conversation that I had, you know, it was for local communication, you know. People were within like a mile or two from each other. You know, it's sort of like when we get on the KCRC 10-meter net. Some days you can hear me, other days you can't hear me.
Well, yeah, I think that's partially just the general atmospheric conditions for ground wave propagation. I used to suggest to Dick that if it was raining, it kind of shifted the resonance of my fan dipoles a bit, and he wasn't particularly enthused with that idea. But I have seen guys who actually had automated antenna tuners that had settings for rainy, foggy, clouded, sunny, snowy, and all kinds of things where it would record the optimized antenna tuner settings and shift according to weather. So there's a lot of variables even with ground wave propagation where some days you'll be able to hear and some days not. Also, it has a lot to do with random background noise. Around my shack, there are spurs that show up every so often, and they'll kind of slowly slide up or down the band. I noticed that afternoon there's a little bit of a crunchy background noise to 10 meters that I don't really perceive at 10:30 or 11 o'clock. So there's all kinds of background possible noise factors that lessen your ability to hear local signals.
Yeah, but, you know, 28.38, you know, for 10 meters, when I tune around, especially when the net is not on, and I can hear, you know, conversations there, mostly skip signals, and maybe also you're getting some of that when you're conducting the net.
Well, some of it, probably. Others, not really, because I've noticed this kind of crunchiness and you know, since the minimum of the sunspot minimum. So I don't think it was skywave propagation that was causing it. And also, you know, I live very close to where the subway has one of their warehouses, so I'm sure they have all kinds of interesting electronic devices that they use. And, you know, I'll have spurs develop on my pan adapter. And as I mentioned, it's not a transmitter because it changes its frequency over time. So it's probably just something that has a parasitic oscillations that shifts independently, you know, over time. So it's probably a little bit of everything.
Well, you know, Roy, it sounds kind of musical, you know. The way music is these days and the kind of sound that you can put in there.
Well, it depends. Some are very solid musical tones. The spur that tends to afflict me on 28.380 is located about 200 or 300 hertz off that frequency, and so on single sideband, it gives me a nice melodic 300 hertz tone, which I'd rather it not be there. So there are melodic tones, there are pure tones, there are harmonic tones, and then there are atonic tones and random noise and such. So you get a little bit of everything if you're listening up on the band.
And 2KW?
Yes, Alan.
Are you sure it's not in your receiver?
Yes, I'm sure it's not in my receiver because it goes away.
Okay. I was wondering if it happened on another receiver.
Well, I get the same tone on my ICOM 7100, so I don't think it's internal.
Okay. Right. You get on another piece of equipment, not internal.
Yeah, it's a local phenomena. I don't know where it's coming from. Usually, I thankfully only see it about 5-6 months out of the year. It'll come, it'll go, it'll slide up the frequency band, it'll slide down the frequency band. But no, it's not inside the radio itself. But, you know, you learn to live with things. I used to notch it, but it's probably more trouble notching it than just kind of getting used to it.
Yeah. I know that it's squiggly. I know the sound, and I have it both at home and in the mobile. And in the mobile, I know it's my alternator, but I'm not sure what it is in the house, over.
Turn the RF gain up and listen for loud signals calling CQ.
Okay, unfortunately, David, Alan stepped on you, so we just heard the last 3-4 seconds of that.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say that, you know, there's so much noise where I am that I guess I just have to learn to accept it. Turn up the RF gain and look for the loud signals, and it's like they're sitting in the room with me.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like AA, you know, change the things you can change, don't change the things that you have no power to change, and look for the wisdom to know the difference between the two. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes it's inside the house, as the old saying goes about horror movies. Sometimes there's a wall wart, we talk about that a lot, there's a fluorescent ballast, there's a solar panel converter. That's causing it in your house. So we tell people regularly, you know, cut the power to the house, put the battery on your radio, and listen for the signal. And if you can still hear it, then it's not in your house. And then you start to work your way out. And the problem is, unfortunately, I don't know about you people, but here in Brooklyn, you know, neighbors aren't very neighborly. Everyone keeps to themselves. And so, you know, knocking on doors and asking them about wall warts will probably get your neighbors a little bit annoyed at you. So sometimes you just got to live with stuff.
And 2KW?
Yes, Alan.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with David's situation because I operated 200 feet from there for years. He's in Lower Manhattan. David, try this. Don't turn up the RF gain and hope for strong signals. On the contrary, turn the RF gain down. Turn the audio gain all the way up and use your RF gain control as the volume control. You'd be surprised how much better you hear, over.
QSL. What I do is I leave the RF gain in neutral. I listen for the signal. If the signal is clearly audible, then I turn up the RF gain. Seemingly, I get a good result that way. Because I like to rag chew, and I like to have a clear, loud signal.
Now, I'm telling you something. Put the audio gain all the way up, and use the RF gain as a volume control. You'll like it. That's for Manhattan. Over.
I'm trying it right now.
Alan, I think that's generally a good suggestion in general. I don't think you should limit it to one borough.
No, I limit it to Manhattan for a reason. There's a lot of RF in Manhattan. There's any number of broadcast stations right across the river from David, the Jersey Meadowlands, and that makes 160 impossible. You can't use an active antenna on any band. It pumps up the noise floor. And it's really, it gives the radio's front end a hard time. And by turning the RF gain down, you're not putting as much signal into the front end. You're not overloading the front end. And you're letting the radio do what it was designed to do, over.
Okay. I just kind of think in most municipal communities, where there's a lot of RF just kind of circulating all over the place. It's never a great idea to be too heavy-handed with the RF gain of a receiver.
Well, most radios give you a choice of a preamp, a straight receiver, or an attenuator, and I never use the preamp. Maybe on 10, but I never use the preamp. Usually I use the attenuator because I know if I hear the guy with the attenuator, he's going to hear me.
Okay, yeah, preamps are not really great for HF because the noise is not internal to your machine, it's external, and so if you're boosting your signal, you're boosting the outside noise. It's only, you know, when you get up maybe 10 meters, but really 2 meters and 70 centimeters and all, where most of the noise generated is internal to the machine, where boosting the signal strength will get you some benefit in the signal-to-noise ratio.
Yeah, and in that case, you want the preamp at the antenna anyway.
Yeah, in a best case type of situation, in sort of the same way that in general the best place for your antenna tuner is at the feed point as well.
Theoretically that's correct. At HF and with the short coax run, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. You know, I got a kick out of what you said before about some people have different settings for rain and snow and ice on their automatic antenna tuner. The ATU keeps your final tappy. That's all it does. Doesn't do a thing for your signal.
I need to do that on my tuner.
Okay, very good. Well, Alan, you touch upon one of those things that are argued on 75 meters, have been argued, will be argued, and probably is being argued as we speak. You're in good company because you have Bob Heil, the ex-owner of the Heil Sound Company, believe that antenna tuners are just fooling people. And then you have people like myself that don't agree. They do offer benefits. They are not perfect solutions, but they are not just scams. We could have that argument so some other time on 75 meters, I guess.
Oh, I never said that the ATUs were scams. I said the ATU keeps your final tappy. And that's a fact. The ATU keeps your final tappy. As far as RF is concerned, at the other end, they're not going to hear any difference.
This sounds pretty good with the RF gain up and the volume down. And I got to wait to see if the elevator motor will sound through this thing.
No, the AF gain up and the RF gain is the volume control. The AF gain is all the way up and the RF gain becomes the volume control.
QSL, that's what it is now. It's the AF gain up and the RF gain down, and I don't hear any noise in the background at all, just voice.
Anyway, word of wisdom from the chat room, John KD2BD. He writes, very reminiscent of good old Dick, K2RIW. He writes, first you resonate, then you radiate. Your antenna matching network helps to bring your antenna system into resonance so that you can actually radiate. So, again, we've had this discussion more than a few times. It's still going on 75 meters. With people who also say that there is a proper length of transmission line and an improper length, and others that say you must never coil your excessive transmission line, always leave it out in a serpentine path, and a bunch of other interesting differences of opinion on 75 meters.
Okay, well, I can understand it not being wise to coil it, or certainly having a large enough coil. Certainly don't want a small coil. I don't know. You know, like I said with the T2FW, you know, T2FD, you're dissipating all the power in the resistor, and that keeps the SWR down, which keeps the transmitter happy. But you're radiating, you're shock exciting 100 feet of wire, and they hear you on any band you're on. Does the beam work better? Absolutely. Absolutely. But is that really an alternative?
Well, again, I think that's a simplistic approach to what antennas do. They do provide a nominal 50-ohm impedance so that your driver circuits don't receive reflected power and don't shut down or blow up or such. But they are still useful for distance resonating your antenna. You're going to get some loss in the components of your antenna tuner. It's not a perfect device. You're going to get some initial loss by the initial reflection of the transmission line, but it's not quite the same as just putting a resistor in, because that would be a lot cheaper than buying what antenna tuners cost.
Comment.
Yes, please, comment.
Isn't the resistor in that folded dipole, and also the resistor at the end of a beverage, and also the resistor at the end of a rhombic, is dissipating what the antenna did not, over?
Well, I would certainly think so. I mean, I'm sure Alan has his opinion. These are all, to my recollection, more traveling wave antennas than standing wave antennas. Again, certainly beverage and the other antenna that you mentioned. But I have to still look up T2FD, whether it's a traveling wave or a standing wave antenna. But Alan, any comments?
I don't really know the difference. I don't know which one it is. But, yeah, the resistor in the rhombic dissipates what the antenna doesn't, and the resistor in the T2FD dissipates what the antenna doesn't. But the resistor in the rhombic, first of all, you don't have to terminate a rhombic, and second of all, the beverage, the resistor in the beverage, you don't have to terminate a beverage. And the beverage isn't the transmitting antenna. So I don't know about why the resistor is there, except that they work. You know, I've used them, and they work well. Sometimes that's the only way you can hear on 160, over.
KG2R1.
Yes, David?
Postscript. Setting the volume all the way up and the RF gain all the way down, and bringing up the RF gain to get the right amount of signal as opposed to noise. From what I can see, with the noise coming from the elevator motor in my building, there is no difference between one or the other, and I tried it with my two or three different signals.
Does your radio have a noise blanker?
Yeah. I don't use a noise blanker. I just look for the loud signal, and I bring up the RF gain until it's nice and clear, and have a QSO with someone, hopefully for a long time, and hopefully some interesting place, some interesting situation.
Okay, I've got a cute anecdote. Let me see if I have it. I brought my radio into the United Nations because theirs was on the fritz, and I was teaching a class there every Friday night. It was a Tentec Delta, and I had the noise blanker in it, and it was totally useless. The noise blanker was totally ineffective on every noise I ever heard. I switched it on and off. That's when I lived near you. and it was totally useless. And so I brought the radio in. Let me drop it. I brought the radio into the UN, and there was terrible noise, QRN, from the elevator. Terrible, terrible noise. And I switched on the noise blanker, and it disappeared completely.
WHCDL Mobile.
Yes, Andy.
Hi, guys. I just got into the car. I just wanted to ask Alan a quick question. Alan, I hear you. Did you get your axle fixed? And you'll understand why I'm asking the question. And Alan, it's funny you mentioned the UN. I have a QSD magazine with your picture in it. Or I should say, a picture of you in it. When you were operating at the UN back in the 1980s with two other hams, and you looked a lot younger.
Who else was in the picture? Jules and Ed?
Yes, W2JGR, who was the first contact that I made when I joined Limog. And of course, Jules moved many years ago, and he passed away many years ago. And the other station, I forget his call, but yes.
Yeah, I remember Jules. It was the first radio teletype operation from the UN.
What is 4U1UN?
4U1UN is a club station of the United Nations Staff Recreation Council. And the ARRL, in its infinite wisdom, decided it's a separate entity for DXCC. So people all over the world are clamoring for a UN contact.
QSL, yeah, there were like 60 overnight.
Yeah, of course, they're very strong. And the only one that operates from there these days is Adrian, K-O-8-S-C-S.
Let me point out, you didn't say they're on 42nd Street in East River.
WHCDL, Roy, can I ask another question?
Sure, Andy.
Okay, I just wanted to get Alan your answer, because I saw Alan up at Nearfest, and I saw what happened to your vehicle. I gather, Alan, you got it fixed and you came down in one piece.
Yeah, that's affirmative. I broke the universal joint between the transfer case and the drive shaft. And the drive shaft was laying on the ground. They towed me out. The part was $22. The repair was $300, and I was home Sunday night.
Yeah, I used the wrong term. You know, I said axle. I didn't mean axle. I meant drive shaft. Right, because it was hanging down. Okay. All right, glad you made it back. And sorry if you missed anything in Nearfest. You know, it was pretty cold up there. I just got back home. I got to run. I'll just be listening for a little while. But I got work to do. So thanks, Roy, for letting me in. And I thought I heard Ed, EAV. Roy, AC2GS, WHCDO.
Well, thank you, Andy, for participating. Any other comments on this particular subject? Gosh, everyone's talked out on it. Okay. Any other questions or comments tonight, science-related, amateur radio-related, what have you?
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
Roy, I don't know if this is a good subject to discuss, maybe even briefly. We were talking about TVs, old TVs, new TVs, and in 1982 in the spring, there was an exhibit at the Whitney for Namjoon Paik. Namjoon Paik, and he took up the entire museum. The whole museum was Namjoon Paik, and the subject was experimental television.
Yes, what about it?
Well, Sony donated 500 TV sets, and in the exhibit there was quite a number of, what they call it, television sculptures, and other kinds of TV machinery. There was a TV cello. The woman played a TV cello. So while she was playing, you know, it was like these two sort of clear plastic boxes with CRTs inside that were projecting, let's say, that were displaying the experimental video.
Okay, yeah, he had a lot of experimental collections of old cathode ray tube television. He passed away, I think, about 2006.
QSL, I remember. And I think it might have been a year before he passed away. I saw him riding the subway in New York. But this particular exhibit that he had in 1982, there was a room, and strapped to the ceiling were 500 CRT TVs facing down. And you lay on your back on a mat and look up at the TVs, and somehow they were coordinated with each other to play some bigger picture, you know? And it's really quite fascinating, especially back in those days. I guess now you basically see it a lot.
I don't know if you see it a lot, but it is certainly technologically much more feasible. They do sell massive flat screen displays that are not too heavy and can actually be ceiling mounted if someone was weirdly inclined. So yeah, you could kind of mimic that, and you would probably have to do some esoteric video remapping to give you the illusion that there are multiple screens of lower resolution giving you a patchwork of images that were coalescing on the ceiling. I haven't seen any of thing like that really done, but I'm sure there are experimental artists out there playing around with things like that. It's just incredibly easier to do engineering-wise now because of the amazing amount of the large, high-resolution, flat-screen display technology.
Yeah, but back in those days, a CRT basically only played 480i, 480i, or the equivalent of 640 by 480 pixels. But, you know, at that time, you know, we were used to it, and we looked at it on a CRT, and it looked like a full picture, you know. And his work was basically abstract. And we found out about this exhibit in a class at NYU, experimental TV class. And our instructor was the curator of experimental TV and installation at the Museum of Modern Art. I don't think she's there anymore.
Yeah, old cathode ray tubes, I knew them and loved them well. They operated in the United States the NTSC standard, 480 interlaced lines. The only thing worse than that is the early VCRs. That originally, the first design was only half of that frame rate. They did something like 240 lines, and if you ever look at a VCR display, it's something that we all kind of were endlessly thrilled over. But yeah, that was a different world, the world of cathode ray tubes and such. And we went on to liquid crystal displays, and we had a little bit of a dance with plasma technology that kind of faded away in favor of organic light-emitting diodes and such.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
I'm trying to imagine the expense this guy must have had to secure 500 CRT TVs up, facing down on a ceiling, knowing people are going to be down there below staring up at these things. That must have been some bill. The amount of support he had to put every now and then to attach to the ceiling. You know? I guess this guy had some money to blow. That must have been some deal. I wonder what the insurance bill was for that.
Yeah, that's what came to mind before anything else, was that the insurance was probably prohibitive. He was very famous for these cathode ray tube displays. He had lots of them. You can do a Google search and find lots and lots of different images of his. They were all cathode ray tubes, obviously. Even though he got to 2006, I don't think he had the same joy of thin film transistor type flat displays. But I assume he was rather successful. He certainly had the fame. So sometimes with fame goes a lot of donations and national art places will donate money to him, I guess. So he was able to keep on pumping those things out, so he must have gotten the money somewhere.
He's got 500 TVs or so.
We could walk along and install, the wiring to each one of these things. That must have been something. Never heard of this, but interesting. Back to you.
Well, what could be more interesting is how he put the signal into the TVs. You know, back then it was U-matic video cassette. I mean, how did it get in there?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, he must have pulled some really fancy electronics to get this accomplished. I mean, nowadays it would be amazingly not that difficult. I mean, there's software that you could just buy that would probably simulate a lot of this. But, back in those times, I don't know that much about him, whether he had any expertise in electrical engineering or he was associated with people who had that that knowledge, but this I would assume this would require a great deal of technological skill to deal with all those images showing up on cathode ray tubes and syncing them in some kind of reasonable way.
Well, the other thing is too, he got a donation of 500 TVs from Sony, and I don't know, how all the rest of it came together. How did they set them up? How the installation went? Did the museum provide manpower, or did he bring his own?
Yeah, all interesting questions. My gut feeling is, if you search long and hard enough, there's got to be some documentarian that did a documentary on him, because I remember him in his day. He was famous. So I would be surprised if absolutely no one, ever assaulted the subject and tried to make a documentary. It would certainly be fascinating to watch.
Well, you can probably get material about him. Also, his works were... His works were exhibited on PBS, and I remember seeing like one hour and a half programs, just these abstract things, and some of his abstract works on Channel 13.
Yeah, and if you do a Google search, they do have... documentaries of one type or another. Apparently, there's a couple of previews available on YouTube, but probably some streaming service has it as part of their 10 trillion list of documentaries available. So if you go searching, I wouldn't be surprised if Netflix has it or Amazon Prime, but you never know what you'll find.
QSL, thank you for discussing this topic. I have to say that have very fond memories of, you know, seeing this work and being involved in it. You know, the experimental video class opened up a lot of doors, and I learned about a lot of different artists that did this kind of work and then other kinds of installation work. And you could easily say that this Nam June Paik exhibit was filled with installation.
Well, yeah, I can imagine. There's a lot of hardware and a lot of development. This is not something you can just cobble together, you know, out of Elmer's glue and some paint and such. So, yeah, it sort of is a shame. Maybe I'm just outside of the loop, but it doesn't seem to be quite as much experimental art being produced and promoted on the usual media. I guess maybe also it's because media has changed a great deal since his high time back in the 80s, where you got it put on TV and everyone saw the TV show. Nowadays, there's 10,000 channels, so it's easy to miss things.
Yeah, yeah, I remember when cable first came out, it was 55 channels with Showtime. And, you know, after like a day or two, I just went totally, I don't want to watch this anymore. It's just not so interesting. Maybe, you know, it's better just to have a regular TV with 13 channels and a couple of UHF channels.
Well, ultimately, you can't stop progress, and this was deemed to be progress. There are so many different sources for entertainment. I tend to think, maybe pessimistically, that there's only so many talented people who can write well and produce well and direct well and film well and photograph well and all these other things. And if you start to dilute with way too many projects, you'll end up getting people who can't kind of write well and can't act terribly well, and you'll get a lot of mediocrity. There's still a lot of gems out there. There's all kinds of things that I found intriguing. I saw Netflix had this basically cartoon which would turn people off, called Arcane, which was beautifully drawn. I mean, each frame looked like it could be a picture. And it was well done. But for each of those, you got Star Trek Discovery. So, you know, what can I tell you?
Well, I think about it this way, you know. A lot of times the media, whatever you get, the result, is directly connected to the technology that made it, you know. For example, let's say there's a photographer who uses a Leica camera, and he's really good at it, you know, takes really great pictures, and people love the pictures, they want to buy a Leica camera, you know. And it becomes more about the camera than the actual picture, you know. And I find art has become more and more like that.
And 2KW.
Yes, Alan.
My favorite art story was the guy who made 100 vacuum impressions of a AC receptacle. Stuck them on the wall at the Museum of Modern Art, and it stayed there for weeks until somebody tried to plug a vacuum in and found that you couldn't plug anything in.
Were they three-pronged plugs or two?
It was two three-pronged plugs, one over the other, in a receptacle complete with the cover plate.
Did it have a museum plaque on it?
No. It just looked like a receptacle where you plug in a vacuum cleaner. But nobody tried to plug in there for quite a while.
QSL. It sounds like the story about the woman, you know, who had her show at the MoMA. What she did was she hung her pictures up inside the stall in the bathroom.
I love it.
Well, you could collect all kinds of interesting art stories. I did one here on the TechNet a couple of years ago in the Science Talk segment. It was about a new technology. Someone had designed, using nanotechnology, the blackest black imaginable. It absorbs something like 99.9994% of all light. And what an artist did was dig a hole in a museum. I don't know how the hell he dug a hole, but he dug a hole in the museum, and then he painted the hole with this jet black. And the idea being that since it doesn't reflect any light, you don't get a sense of dimensionality from the black hole. So it sort of looks like it's a floor with that someone put painted a red circle, a black circle on. And so, of course, they didn't cordon it off for some stupid reason. So, of course, someone going to the museum decided to walk on the spot on the ground and fell down the hole.
Nice, nice, nice. Well, you know, black isn't a color, you know.
Yes, it's an absence of light. It's not any color. But, yes, I agree. I didn't say the color black, but, yes, I agree. White isn't a color either.
Well, white is a combination of all the colors. They had a color wheel at the Brooklyn Children's Museum when I grew up, which had all the colors of the rainbow. And when you push the button, like a pizza pie, all the colors of the rainbow, when you push the button, it spun and it turned white.
Well, yes, but there are colors that don't show up on the rainbow.
Yes, there's above the red and above the violet and below the red.
No, there are visible colors that you can get crayons for that you can't point out on the rainbow or on a prism.
Well, you may not be able to point them out, but you can replicate them by mixing colors of the rainbow.
Yes, but that's not the same as colors in the rainbow.
No, you just can't differentiate when the red turns to orange. You can't see the subtle differences. When the orange turns to yellow, you can't see that little differences in there, but they're in there.
Okay, orange is in the rainbow and in prisms. It's red, green, blue. What is it? Red, green, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, and there are colors in the middle, in between. But you will not get the color brown coming out of a prism or out of a rainbow.
Ah, brown is interesting. Brown is interesting. You get brown by mixing up all the paints.
Well, it depends. Theoretically, depending upon what all the paints mean, you could end up with black or very, very dark brown. But, you know, there are some colors that are perceptual. They're not, you can't say, you know, what is the, you could say what's the electron volt of a blue photon. And someone will give you a number. It's something like 4.2 electron volts. You can say what's the number of energy electron volts for a red photon, but you can't kind of say what's the electron volts for a brown photon. There is no such thing as a brown photon. Brown is a perceived color by the way that we perceive light in our eyes and our brain.
Ah, but brown light must have a measurable wavelength.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. It has a combination of different wavelengths that our brain kind of looks at and says, okay, I'm going to call that brown. But it's not a specific. If you had some kind of a dial that could adjust the frequency of electromagnetic energy from red all the way to violet, there is no place that you would be able to stop and say, that's brown.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
Light does not have to be a single color. I was in college, And I got a crazy idea. I was able to get a diffraction grating and a slit and built my own cheap and dirty spectrometer. And I turned it to one of those two mercury arc street lamps. And I was shocked to see it had like green and blue, very